From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It was barely 2 weeks ago when the reporter Tim Weiner warned the Trump administration not to drive itself crazy chasing down leaks. Weiner has written a biography of Richard Nixon. He's won a Pulitzer and a National Book Award for his coverage of intelligence and national security. And he says it was this obsession over leaks that really got Watergate going. Today in the program, Weiner is joining us to talk about the parallels in the story playing out now in Washington and Richard Nixon's attempt to keep the FBI off the trail of a third-rate burglary. The conversation is about the historical and the current relationship between a president and the FBI. Join us after the news.
Hey, Radio West listener. We thought you'd want to know that the book we're talking about on today's podcast just happens to be available on Audible. Go to RadioWest.org and you'll find a link included with the show, along with links to IndieBound and Amazon, and any purchases you make through these affiliate partners help support Radio West. Thanks so much.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. It seems clear the FBI's investigation into Russia's meddling in the 2016 presidential election was growing in size and scope when President Trump abruptly fired FBI Director James Comey last week, which at the time raised questions about whether that's why he did it, to put an end to the investigation. The president's rationale has shifted. At first, the White House said Comey had been dismissed because the Attorney General and Deputy Attorney General recommended it. But then the president himself said in an interview with NBC that he would have fired the director regardless. And he said he had been motivated in part by the Russia investigation. He also said it was because Comey was a showboat and a grandstander. Now, this week, another twist in the story is the New York Times reported that in an Oval Office meeting last February, the president asked Comey to shut down the Russia investigation. Comey refused and recorded the incident in a memo. The White House has denied that. But either way, Tim Weiner says the investigation is not going away because the FBI is a powerful machine. Weiner has written a history of the FBI and a biography of Richard Nixon, so he seemed the perfect person to discuss what seems to be the connections between the FBI's investigation of Russia and the FBI's investigation into Watergate. Weiner's joining us today. He's a former New York Times correspondent. These days, he provides commentary for the news agency Reuters. His reporting on U.S. intelligence has earned him a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. He joined us from his home in New York City. So you've called this investigation, let me quote you here, one of the most delicate and potentially the most dangerous counterintelligence cases in the 108-year-old history of the FBI. Let me have you start there, because it sounds like for you, your sense of the stakes are pretty high.
Yes, I think it's the most explosive counterintelligence case that the FBI has had since the Soviets stole the secrets of the atomic bomb during and after World War II.
One of the things you explain in your book on the history of the FBI is that we often think of the FBI as a police force, but really you say it's a secret intelligence service and that it creates this natural conflict. There's this continual conflict you write about between this, you know, open democracy and the conduct of intelligence. Would you talk a little bit about that conflict?
Well, that's exactly right. The FBI is and always has been a secret intelligence agency as well as a law enforcement agency. And law enforcement and intelligence are two very different animals. A cop who sees a bad guy wants to string him up. A counter spy, an intelligence officer who sees a bad guy, a spy who's spying against the United States, wants to string him along. Because once you've strung him up, the trail of evidence is ended. He wants to string him along and find out what he knows and find out who he's talking to and find out who his real master is. And that takes time and patience and extraordinary secrecy. And it's not like handling a bank robbery. It's counter-espionage, and it is, to use a phrase, a wilderness of mirrors. And you can get lost in there. But when a case comes to fruition, you have rolled up a network of enemy spies and their American agents who are working to subvert the United States.
There's this epigraph in your book, Enemies, from Alexander Hamilton, where he says, "Safety from external danger is the most powerful director of national conduct. To be more safe, the citizens," he says, "are willing to run the risk of being less free." Now, how do you figure Americans are thinking about all of this right now? Because it seems like the argument is centered on the political dimensions, you know, whichever side you're on. But do you think Americans are aware or concerned enough, for example, about Putin and Russia and the larger concerns about all of this?
Well, if they read a newspaper, a good newspaper, they understand that as Senator John McCain, Republican of Arizona, the last Cold Warrior standing in the Senate, has said that what Russia did to us in the 2016 election was an act of war, his words. Yeah. And that it is an attack that is continuing and will continue in 2018 and 2020. Unless we understand who did this, how they did it, and whom, if any, among our own citizens aided and abetted them. Until we get to the bottom of what they did in 2016, it'll keep happening. Jim Comey, the deposed FBI director, has said that. The directors of National Intelligence, head of the NSA, have said that. And these are pretty high stakes.
Yeah. Let me back up and have you talk a little bit about the history. Because I want people to get a sense of the scope of the power and the limits of the power of the FBI. But look, we have to talk about J. Edgar Hoover, of course. And you point out in your book that Hoover has become kind of a caricature, seen as a tyrant, a cross-dressing crank. But you say that caricature isn't true, that he was more a Machiavelli than he was a monster.
That's quite right. He was an American Machiavelli. He served as director of the FBI for 48 years until he died in 1972. And he was, in his day, the probably best known and certainly most feared person in Washington, including presidents. Everybody knew what J. Edgar Hoover was. He was this bulldog with a Tommy gun, but he was also the inventor of American anti-communism and the chief of secret information.
Yeah.
He lived by fear. He ruled by fear. And the Bureau as an institution was both respected and feared for the power they had to destroy people who were the political enemies of the President of the United States. I would include foremost among them, Dr. Martin Luther King.
Yeah. There's this great story you tell in the book of John Ehrlichman going to FBI headquarters early in the Nixon administration to see Hoover and the levels of rooms that he has to go through. And he finally gets to this kind of throne room of Hoover's.
Yeah, it's like going to see the Wizard of Oz. And Hoover is sitting, as he always sat, on a dais, an elevated platform. He wasn't very tall. He was maybe 5.5 feet tall, maybe 5'7". But he made sure that he would always look down on whomever was his audience. And to cut to the chase here, Jim Comey, while he served as the FBI director, kept under the glass top of his desk at FBI headquarters a letter written by J. Edgar Hoover and signed by Attorney General Bobby Kennedy, drafted by Hoover, and rewritten under and signed and filed under the authority of the Attorney General of the United States, Robert F. Kennedy, giving Hoover blanket authorization to wiretap Martin Luther King 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 365 days a year. And Comey kept that there as a reminder of the enormous power that the FBI director has, the enormous power that the prosecutor has, and the potential for the abuse of that power, which is unlimited.
I wanted to ask you, when does a president lose the prerogative of being able to appropriately, properly let go of an FBI director? Because you point out the FBI has never had a legal charter really beyond the president's oath. So at what, clearly the director serves at the pleasure of the president, but it seems like there comes a point when a president loses that prerogative because there's an investigation in place.
Prior to the past week, and I cannot emphasize this enough, prior to the past week, no president who knew that he was under investigation by the FBI, that his White House was under investigation by the FBI, that his campaign was under investigation by the FBI, has had the temerity to dismiss the FBI director, because that would be perceived as an obstruction of justice. Example, for most of his presidency, Bill Clinton was under investigation in one way, shape, or form by the FBI, led by its director from mid-1993 until the end of the Clinton administration, Louis Freeh. Yeah. Louis had been an FBI agent. He had been a federal prosecutor. He had been a federal judge. He was young, like Clinton, you know, in his 40s. But he viewed the president from late 93, early 94 onward for 7 years, not so much as the commander-in-chief, but as the subject of a criminal investigation, which Clinton continuously was, rightly or wrongly. And so Louis Freeh turned in his White House pass. This is the FBI director under Clinton in the 90s. He and Clinton spoke perhaps five or six times, no more than six, in the course of 7 years. And Louis Freeh didn't set foot in the White House, but his agents did eventually in 1997, and literally, in the presence of the White House physician, drew blood from the president's arm to obtain his DNA, to match it with the infamous blue dress. I won't go into details here. Spare your listeners. Yeah. But that was proof that the president had committed perjury. Clinton could have no more fired Louis Freeh than he could have, you know, sent his child to prison. It would have been perceived immediately as an obstruction of justice. Only Trump has had the temerity to do so.
I want to have you talk a little bit about the context of the Nixon administration as compared to the Trump administration. Because you write about the early days of the Nixon presidency. And it seems there are a lot of connections between that and the Trump presidency. Nixon, you write, believed that the protests over the war in Vietnam, for example, and the race riots and a lot of the social unrest, all of that was a threat to the country. And he tries to remake the Supreme Court by appointing conservative justices, wants to reestablish, as you put it in your book, respect for the law and the power of the presidency, hires a very conservative man as attorney general. I don't want to make too much of the comparison, but there seems to be some important parallels. Do you believe that?
There are certainly parallels between what we are seeing now and the Watergate case as it unraveled, with some important differences. Yeah. It took Nixon and his plumbers 3.5 years to break into the Democratic National Committee headquarters, Well, by the time Trump got into office, the Russians had already done that on his behalf, hadn't they? Okay, mission accomplished. It took Nixon 4.5 years into his second term before he had to start firing some of his closest aides and trying to build a stonewall around the White House to keep the hounds at bay, the hounds being the FBI and the Watergate special prosecutor. Well, Trump's already done that. It took into the fifth year, well into the fifth year of Nixon's presidency, for the existence of a smoking gun tape in which the president is clearly obstructing justice by trying to kill the FBI investigation of the Watergate break-in before its existence became known, and literally a week or two before his impeachment, before his resignation, excuse me, for that tape to actually surface. Well, that tape now exists, except it's NBC News videotape. The president blithely and boldly and brazenly told NBC News last week, yeah, I fired Comey because I was sick of this investigation, this whole Russia hoax. It's as if he has begun to construct the case for his own impeachment by himself. It's an extraordinary thing, particularly for those of us who are so old that we actually remember Watergate and lived through it, to see this happening in real time.
Describe Nixon's relationship with J. Edgar Hoover. You were just talking about Clinton's relationship with Louis Free. We know about Donald Trump's relationship with James Comey. Hoover and Nixon had been, as you write in your book, cronies for more than 20 years when Nixon became president. But he didn't fully trust him, but he spoke with him a lot. This was really interesting. In your book, you say that Hoover and Nixon spoke, I think it was nearly 40 times face-to-face or by phone in the first 2 years of Nixon's administration.
Nixon and Hoover had been partners in political life for 25 years. Yeah. Nixon got his start as a junior congressman on the House Committee on Un-American Activities, listening to Hoover address the Un-American Activities Committee in a stunning speech, which bears rereading, in the spring of 1947, in which he said that America was under attack by people from Moscow who were burrowing into the government, into the State Department, into the Army, and even, as Hoover later found to his horror, into the FBI. Nixon and Hoover were the two leading American anti-communists of the Cold War. They were inseparable. Nixon called Hoover my closest personal friend in all of political life, which is something of a misstatement, because outside his family, Nixon really didn't have any friends, and neither did Hoover. But they thought alike, even if they didn't look alike. And their paths to power were both carved through crusading anti-communism. But then there came a break, a rupture in their relationship in June of 1970. The president wanted to remove all restrictions on the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, and the military spying on Americans in order to root out his enemies, foreign and domestic, the people who opposed the war, the people who opposed Nixon, the people who marched on Washington, up to and including sitting Democratic members of the Senate and the House, and going all the way to the left end of the spectrum to the Students for a Democratic Society and the Black Panthers and the Weathermen. And Hoover wouldn't sign off on this plan.
Yeah.
He was 75 years old. He knew his days were numbered. And he was scared that they were going to get caught.
Yeah.
And that his reputation and the reputation of the institution that he loved, that he created, with which he was synonymous, the FBI, would be tarnished. And he said, I'm not going to do your dirty work anymore. In so many words, he refused to sign off on this plan. And so Nixon was forced to create his own little bucket shop in the basement of the White House. They became known as the plumbers because they were originally created to stop leaks of information.
Yeah.
And these are the gang of idiots who broke into the Democratic National Headquarters in June of 1972, committed the, as the president's spokesman said, third-rate burglary that led to the undoing of Richard Nixon. Hoover died 6 weeks before the Watergate break-in.
Wow.
If he had lived, it never would have happened.
So Nixon figures Hoover had lost the will.
His nerve, his nerve, lost his steel. That's right.
These leaks, let's talk about that, because it's fascinating. Nixon's obsession with leaks seems, and we'll talk about this here in a moment, that Donald Trump's administration has a similar kind of obsession or concern, however you want to put it, about leaks. And you're right that LBJ warned Nixon, it's the leaks that can kill you. And Nixon would go apoplectic, it seems, when he read about leaks.
Yes, by May of 1969, in the fifth month of his presidency, Nixon was ordering his national security advisor, Henry Kissinger, to start wiretapping his own staff and reporters and senior State Department officials whom he feared were leaking the Nixon administration's war plans to the press. One of the bizarre aspects, not the only one, of the Trump presidency is here we are in May, just as Nixon was in the May, the spring of his first term, and Trump has been talking about tapes and bugs and Obama bugged me and Comey better hope there aren't any tapes of our conversations. And old Watergate buffs like me wonder, are there?
Yeah.
Are there tapes? Is Trump taping people in the White House? Is he crazy? Does he want to do himself in? Because that is the road to hell, trying to plug leaks by taping people in the White House.
Sean Spicer, didn't he mention that to his staff that their calls could be monitored or would
be? Calls may be monitored for quality insurance. That's right. He at one point told them to hand over their cell phones so they could be checked so that they weren't calling 212-556-1234, which is the switchboard of the New York Times. Just in case anybody out there in your listening audience has any tips, that number is 212-556-1234.
I wanted to kind of go back to Nixon. I think it's such a remarkable moment, Nixon ordering Kissinger to take responsibility for these leaks and basically wiretap people. Because you write about this in your book. He tells him to tape prominent reporters and columnists, members of the NSC staff and the Pentagon and the State Department. It's pretty amazing.
Well, and it got to the point where everybody was bugging everybody else because Mel Laird, who was the Secretary of Defense, found out about this right quick. And he had his liaison officer, the guy, he was a Navy yeoman, who was the Pentagon's liaison officer to the NSC, literally empty the garbage cans of Henry Kissinger and his military aide, Al Haig, and put them in his own burn bag and take them back to the Pentagon. This guy was the Pentagon spy inside the White House. His name was Yeoman Radford, and they found out about him, and rather than hang him for treason, they sent him out to some post in Oregon, like as a fire watcher, from which he never returned. And the level of spy versus spy that was going on at that time within the administration was a reflection of the paranoia of the president. But even paranoids have enemies. And Nixon had enemies within his own administration, or so he felt. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the Pentagon spying on the White House is spying on the Pentagon. The FBI is investigating the president. The acting head of the FBI, the number two guy, turns out to be Deep Throat. He's feeding the Washington Post. Mm-hmm. As the investigation of Watergate continues, the only way you can really understand the way it felt back then is to see a movie by Francis Ford Coppola called The Conversation, which was made in 1974, and it's all about surveillance and the idea that Big Brother really is watching you, or at least listening to you. Well, fast forward now through the decades, and we're watching all this unfold at warp speed, aren't we?
That's Tim Weiner. He's a longtime reporter on intelligence and espionage. He's the author of a number of books on the histories of the CIA, the FBI. He also wrote a biography of Richard Nixon. We'll take a break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're talking about the relationship between an American president and the FBI with Tim Weiner, whose reporting on U.S. intelligence has earned him a Pulitzer Prize and a National Book Award. He's also written a biography of Richard Nixon. So I want to quote something you wrote on May 1st. This is for Reuters. You were writing about how the president would be advised not to go on the warpath against the FBI and Congress and the press corps over these leaks. And you point out in this piece how those forces are always in opposition. And you wrote this. You wrote, "But a free press can work in concert with federal investigators if they align against the White House. A critical mass of shared information will gather. That information could someday take the shape of a subpoena seeking the traces of a smoking gun." This was on May 1st. And now we learn, of course, Utah Congressman Jason Chaffetz, head of the House Oversight Committee, on Tuesday, says he intends to subpoena this reported memo James Comey is said to have written after President Trump allegedly told him to back off of this investigation.
That was 2 weeks ago, right?
2 weeks ago.
I'm impressed. It's really almost impossible to overstate the immensity of what this looks like to people like me who've been covering secret intelligence, national security, the CIA, the FBI, and presidents since the 1970s or 80s. The British burned down the White House in the War of 1812. And to people like me, it looks like there's an arsonist in the White House who is intent on burning the frameworks, the foundations, the fundamental pillars of American political society. He attacks the CIA as Nazis. He calls the FBI's biggest investigation, which is about him and his allies, a hoax and a charade. Okay. He appoints people to positions at the head of agencies that they have vowed to dismantle. The Department of Education is run by somebody who doesn't believe in public education. The Department of Energy is run by a guy who couldn't name the department when he was running for president. That would be the former governor of Texas, Rick Perry. And I think as we speak today, in mid-May, you are beginning to see the Republican base in the Senate, if not the House, start to fidget. People like Senator John McCain, who's 80 years old, a prisoner of war at the Hanoi Hilton for 5.5 years, whom Trump insulted to the marrow of his bones, saying, I like people who weren't captured. McCain's not a hero. Are you kidding me? You don't insult John McCain. People like Lindsey Graham, who heads the Judiciary Committee. People like Senator Richard Burr of North Carolina, who heads the Intelligence Committee. These are bedrock Republicans. And they know that Trump is not a Republican. He's not. He's not a politician. He is a uniquely American phenomenon, a reality television star who has conned his way into the presidency of the United States. And I don't want to go out on any limbs. I don't have a crystal ball here. But I don't see how he gets to a second term.
I want to come back to that, actually, because I think some of this question of obstruction of justice, this question of invoking the 25th Amendment, these are questions, sure, you've thought about. Let me ask you something about something you had said before about these leaks and this obsession about leaks. Nixon had it. Trump seems to have it. You talk about the importance of leaks. And on one hand, you say a leak, you said this recently in a podcast for Reuters, that a leak is, on one hand, an unauthorized disclosure of classified information. It's a phrase that's, as you say, written into law. But then there's another way of thinking about leaks, and you say that they're a free flow of information in a democratic society. It's a way of exposing when the machine of government is breaking down. Would you just talk about that?
Yes. I've been the subject, to my knowledge, of 3 criminal leak investigations conducted by the FBI about stories that I've published concerning the activities of the CIA. And almost without exception, over the past 40 years, these leak investigations, when they're targeting reporters, never come to fruition. The person who is leaking the information, the government official, is making an unauthorized disclosure of classified information. Well, you work around Washington covering national security long enough, and you come to realize that everything is classified. And as a conservative Supreme Court justice wrote in the Pentagon Papers case, in which the New York Times was ruled by the Supreme Court to be free to publish the classified study of the Vietnam War, known as the Pentagon Papers, over the objection of the Nixon administration, this justice wrote, "When everything is classified, nothing is classified." The overclassification of everything leads to a kind of a contempt for the security system. I give you briefly Mr. Snowden. Mm. Here's a 29-year-old sysop without a college degree, who is a contractor, who is carrying around the keys to the kingdom. He's got a key ring on his pocket that's got like a billion keys on it.
Right.
Okay? That can open every compartment of value where some of the most closely held secrets of the NSA reside. What is, with all due respect to Mr. Snowden and his opponents and his supporters, what is a 29-year-old sysop doing carrying around the keys to the kingdom? You can blame Snowden. You can call him a traitor. But the NSA, the National Security Agency, is insecure if a key ring like that is floating around on the belt of some guy in Hawaii. My point is this. Presidents and intelligence agencies leak secrets all the time. And sometimes it's for the good of the nation because something terrible has happened and the people need to know. When the United States was torturing prisoners in Abu Ghraib and in secret prisons spread around the world, you know who blew the whistle on that? It was the FBI. It was specifically an agent named Ali Soufan, who's an American hero. Okay, when the FBI is blowing the whistle on torture being committed by the CIA and the Army, that's not a leak. That's an alarm. Now, Ali Soufan could have gone to prison for that.
Yeah.
He didn't. Okay. I conceivably could have gone to prison for some of the stories that I published. I didn't, and I never will, because we have freedom of the press in this country and freedom of speech. But when the president of the United States does, as he quite clearly did, and by his own admission in a tweet that went out at 7:03 in the morning on Tuesday, spills secrets that have been entrusted to the United States by the Israelis on the condition that they not be shared with any other country. When he spills those secrets to a strategic adversary, that would be Sergei and Sergei, the two Russians, the foreign minister and the ambassador, whom he was palling around with in the Oval Office. That is a leak. And a dangerous one. And one that is arguably in violation of his oath of office to protect this country against its enemies.
I want to ask you about that, because this you've raised the significance of this leak. One of the points you make in a commentary, in fact, the commentary that you wrote today, is that what the president did doesn't necessarily have to be illegal in order for him to be removed from office. You quote a particular lawyer under the administration of George W. Bush, Jack Goldsmith, who said that even if there isn't criminal exposure, an abuse of power can be an impeachable offense if it's a breach of trust. Would you work me through that?
Impeachment is inherently a political process with a legal foundation. It is not a criminal proceeding, although it looks like one. Okay, you cannot indict a sitting president in a federal courthouse. We think. It's never been done.
Yeah.
When Nixon ran afoul of the law, as he did, he was named an unindicted co-conspirator in a case in which his own attorney general and his closest aides were indicted and convicted. The course of appointing a special prosecutor has happened in the Watergate case, and working through the Justice Department and the FBI now seems hopelessly corrupted, or compromised, I should say, by the Attorney General's intercession in the matter, despite his vow to recuse himself, and by the president's firing of the FBI director. So the recourse for the redress of abuses of power lies with Congress. The impeachments of three presidents, Andrew Johnson, Richard Nixon, and Bill Clinton, the predicate offenses were crimes like obstruction of justice or perjury, but the counts of impeachment were almost all abuses of power, the abuse of power. And that is a phrase rooted in the Constitution and in the oath of office. An abuse of power can be predicated upon a crime like obstructing of justice, but ultimately what it is a violation of your oath of office to protect and defend the Constitution and to take care that the laws of the United States are faithfully executed and to defend this nation against its enemies.
That's Tim Weiner. He's a longtime reporter on intelligence and espionage, the author of a number of books on the histories of the CIA and the FBI. We'll take another quick break and come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Back now to our conversation with Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Tim Weiner, who warns that President Trump's firing of FBI Director James Comey and his crusade to stop leaks has important parallels with the Nixon administration. Ross Douthat of The New York Times has written about this constitutional mechanism that would allow for the removal of the president, even if he wasn't convicted of high crimes and misdemeanors. It's the 25th Amendment, where the vice president and a majority of the cabinet would inform Congress that the president's not able to discharge his duties and they remove him. What do you think about that particular mechanism? It's hard to imagine there would be the political will to do something like that, but I wanted to get your sense of it.
Well, it's a pipe dream. You would have to have a congressional declaration that the president is crazy. And I don't foresee that. The historical basis for this is that President Woodrow Wilson, after World War I, had a stroke and was really incapacitated for many, many months. And it was kept secret from the American people. And his cabinet and his wife basically ran the country while Wilson lay in bed in the White House, invisible to the American people and barely capable of speech. Now, if the president had a heart attack or, started suddenly speaking in tongues, there would be a hue and a cry and an alarm about his ability to faithfully execute the duties of his office, and then you could have an invocation of the 25th Amendment. But you're not going to have it because the president is, a mad tweeter. Right. Or, because he writes the nuclear launch codes on a sticky note and, leaves them on his desk for a Russian photographer to photograph. That didn't happen. We think.
Yeah.
But the 25th Amendment is a pipe dream. You can leave it to the thriller novelists, except that real life is now so far exceeding the bounds of the imagination of thriller writers, be they authors of potboilers or Hollywood filmmakers, that the imagination is being outstripped on a daily, almost hourly basis by what's going on in Washington. It really is remarkable, isn't it?
Yeah. Let me come back to James Comey for a moment, because you've written about him, and this was interesting. James Comey, you've pointed out, has told a president no before. Back in May of 2005, he said no to President George W. Bush about the NSA program of spying on America.
2004,
right. Forgive me. And he said at the time to his fellow NSA officers, no must be spoken into a storm of crisis.
Yeah, he actually gave a speech to the National Security Agency about this in 2005, and then he testified in public to the Senate about what had happened later in 2007. Probably the most dramatic testimony anyone has heard in the Senate in many years. It will only be eclipsed or outdone by the testimony he's about to deliver to Congress in coming days. Briefly, it's complicated. What happened was this. After 9/11, President George W. Bush ordered the National Security Agency to greatly expand its capabilities of electronic eavesdropping and technical espionage, and collect the telephone conversations and email correspondences of Americans. The NSA isn't supposed to do that. It's a foreign intelligence agency. It's a military intelligence agency. But in the atmosphere, as we all remember, after 9/11, everyone was very afraid. The secrecy level went through the roof, as did the fear level. And the ignorance of, you know, if and when there was a follow-on attack was deep. And that toxic combination of fear, secrecy, and ignorance led to the president authorizing the NSA to spy on Americans. So in the spring of 2004, in March of 2004, and in weeks that followed, the Attorney General of the United States, John Ashcroft, fell deathly ill. Immediately after, his deputy, the number two guy in the Justice Department, who is Jim Comey, and the head of the FBI at the time, who was Robert S. Mueller III, found out about the NSA spying program and told the Attorney General, this is unconstitutional and it cannot be reauthorized in its present form. It has to be scaled back. Ashcroft heard this, pondered it, and hours later succumbed to a potentially fatal attack of gastric peritonitis, which is potentially fatal. He had to have gallbladder surgery. He had to be fully sedated, and he was deathly ill in the hospital when Bush sent two of his top aides to get him in his semi-conscious state to sign a piece of paper reauthorizing the NSA spying. Jim Comey, who is 6'8", took the stairs two at a time at Georgetown University Hospital. And Bobby Mueller came up with his black car with his sirens screaming from the FBI. They got to the hospital and they had a kind of a high noon showdown in Ashcroft's hospital room with Bush's representatives, the White House counsel and the chief of staff on one side, and Comey and Mueller on the other. And every witness who was there testifies, including Ashcroft's wife, that he lifted his head off the pillow and he pointed like the ghost of Christmas past, pointed to Jim Comey and said, "There stands the Attorney General," because Comey was the acting Attorney General, because Ashcroft was incapacitated under the same terms of the 25th Amendment we were talking about.
Yeah.
So everybody goes back to the White House, and the following morning, Comey and Mueller come in, and they say to Bush, "You got to skin this back." The NSA spying campaign, codenamed Stellar Wind. And Bush writes in his memoirs, and everyone present agrees that what flashed in front of President Bush's eyes was the Saturday night massacre. He writes this in his memoirs, Decision Points, that Mueller, the acting attorney general, the head of the FBI, Mueller, and Comey, the acting attorney general, and Ashcroft, the attorney general, were all prepared to resign if he didn't scale back this secret spying program. And he did it. So the point of this is that Comey has said no to presidents before, and it is very hard for the FBI director or the attorney general or anyone representing justice to stand in front of the speeding freight train that is the power of the presidency and say no, stop, or even slow down. And on that rock, Comey's reputation stands.
Tim Weiner, he's the author of a number of books about the CIA, the FBI, and President Richard Nixon. He also provides regular commentary on politics and U.S. intelligence for the news agency Reuters. He joined us from his home in New York City. Radio West is a production of KUER News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.